This is a Cultural Icons interview. I'm Rodney Wilson, and today I'm interviewing Peter Webb. Peter, the world knows you as Peter Webb Galleries, Webb's Auction House, the key figure in the resale art market over the last several decades, but you've been at the pioneering end of so much in the New Zealand visual arts. So I wondered if we could traverse those early years first and then talk a bit about the resale market later on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Peter, from what I understand from you, you or your parents had the view that you weren't particularly academic. They sent you to Seddon Memorial Tech College. Typography was where you, well, what was purported to be typography, was where your education was. And after that, after coming out of that, am I right in believing that Eric Westbrook engaged you as an assistant at the art gallery?
Yes. And this interview is taking place in Devonport, and it's just within a short walk to where we started our little ceramic business, Ian Firth and I. And it was there that Westbrook, who'd come to address a group of North Shore potters, met me. And after the meeting, although I performed abysmally because I was supposed to give a speech, and I stood up and I was so nervous that I couldn't utter a single word. I just went red in the face, and Westbrook had to get up to rescue me, which he did after an embarrassing pause. And but it didn't seem to affect his interest in my joining the Art Gallery staff, which was wonderful.
Now, your career as a potter and your association with Ian Firth preceded that time at the Art Gallery, did it?
Yes, it did, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about you, Peter Webb, the potter?
Well, he didn't do a hell of a lot of potting, I must say, because I was great at starting things. I mean, I initiated in Devonport, I initiated a soccer club called the Waitemata Football Club, but that only lasted a year, and I got bored with that and moved on. And I initiated a children's page in the local North Shore Gazette, and I had another writer, the local vicar's son, and Marsden Stanton, and we called ourselves Star and Twinkle. Very embarrassing now that when I think about it. But I actually initiated this whole North Shore ceramic thing, and by, I think, advertising, or I don't know, word of mouth. And there was a group of about 20 people involved, and they came along to this meeting that Westbrook addressed. Yeah. And but after about a year, I'd moved on from that too. Although I just was starting to have success as a potter, selling through Art of the Potter in Victoria Street, who imported and sold works from Bernard Leach's St. Ives Pottery, so I felt I was in good company there. But I can't quite remember why I gave it away. Probably the whole business was getting terribly into debt, and I needed to go and earn a living somewhere. I don't know, I can't remember now, but Westbrook offered me this job, and that was really the beginning of my art education, because I found myself working with Colin McCann as his assistant.
Now, Eric Westbrook, of course, is, we all acknowledge, was really the beginning of professional art gallery management.
Absolutely.
So you were in there at the beginning of the transformation, not only of the Auckland Art Gallery, but by implication, all the art galleries of New Zealand.
Yes, that's right. He certainly was, he certainly turned things over.
Yes.
When he came. I mean, it wasn't difficult really, because after all, the gallery was such a moribund old place. Paintings were hung and left hanging for years and years and years, and just dusted occasionally, and that was the that was the way it was run.
And what was the role that he recruited you for?
Well, the only way he could get me employed, and McCann was employed the same way to start with, because the council just didn't have a job description for a keeper, which McCann became, and neither did it have a job description for an assistant to McCann, a technical assistant, I forget what I was called, but student assistant. That's what I became, but at the time I was employed as a cleaner attendant, and I had to go to work and sweep and mop the floors and toilets. And the nicest part of the job was sitting on the desk when the other attendants had their lunch break, and in the weekends when I probably sat at the front desk for a whole day, because I was able to read my way through all of Thomas Hardy's novels, which was wonderful.
Now, of course, these were incredibly formative years. You were living out at Titirangi at the time, weren't you? And I think you commuted to and
well,
from work with Colin McCann.
Once I fell under McCann's spell, I couldn't let him out of my sight. He was my guru. And so he lived at Titirangi, and I found a little batch just around the corner from him. So I went home with him in the bus every night, came to work with him in the bus every morning, and that was a 40-minute journey each way. So apart from working with him all day, I had him going home and coming to work every day as well. And occasionally saw him in the weekends. I might help out doing some work on his property, you know. I think my concrete path that I helped build with Colin is still there in the McCann house.
And after a while, you left the City Gallery. And was that when you set up Argus Gallery?
Yes. Colin, Westbrook left and went to Australia, and fulfilled the function that he could fulfil, which was to get the place opened up and receptive to contemporary art and new ideas and so on. And he went on to Australia, and Peter Tomrie arrived, and he was great, and he was the right person to follow Westbrook, because he came with a totally different, you know, a more academic approach.
Yes.
And I think that, I strongly suspect that he and McCann would have discussed my future, because I'd been there for 4 years, I think, at this stage. And I know Colin was a bit concerned about me, because I wasn't in the slightest bit interested in studying art history. And not that there was a department of art history in those days, but I mean, I clearly wasn't going to be an academic. So I think that they probably agreed that I should be persuaded to look at the commercial world, where there was clearly an opening.
Yes.
For someone who would, you know, start promoting New Zealand contemporary art.
Yes. And now, of course, there had been John Leech galleries in Auckland decades and decades and decades earlier in Fishers and Christchurch that were gallery retail spaces.
Essentially,
that sold
picture
frame. But the modern dealer gallery didn't exist at that time. Was Argus the first?
Well, it was, because it had no other means of support other than my copy holding for proofreaders at the New Zealand Herald at night.
Yes.
Whereas there had been a gallery before mine in Wellington that was Helen Hitchings?
Yes.
I think, yeah, Helen Hitchings gallery. And that was essentially a coffee shop.
Yes.
Which displayed contemporary New Zealand art. And McCann and Wollaston, all those people showed there with her. But that really was supported by a cafe.
Yes.
Whereas I had nothing to support me at all. So that's the reason it didn't last terribly long.
Yes. Nonetheless, as a stake in the ground, you could say that the modern concept of an art dealer and a dealer gallery was born in Argus Gallery.
Yes, it's flattering to call it a gallery when I think back, because, I mean, the premises were minute and my bedroom was the gallery. So in the mornings I had to get rid of all the bed linen and brush down the divan and clear away any other evidence of my, you know, occupation, nocturnal occupations, and turn it into the gallery again. But and that the space would have been only about 3 meters by 4 or 5 meters, so it was a very small,
yes,
and no wall suitable for hanging big paintings.
Right. Through your time with Colin McCann, I think you were exhibiting McCann, weren't you? And even the Titirangi.
Yes, the second and the most important show I ever had there was of his French Bay paintings. They were wonderful paintings, and that's the only show that you could call a major show of New Zealand art that I held there. The others were all fairly minor things that I showed. But you know, I don't believe we sold one painting from that show.
Yes.
When you think of the demand for them today.
Yes, I can remember in the early 60s in Christchurch when McCann and Wollaston, quite respectable paintings could be picked up at 5 or 7 guineas, and not many of them were sold at that price.
No, that's right. Mm. That's right. Well, I had a little Reader Angus, beautiful little Reader Angus watercolours of flowers that she sent me. And I showed those, and I only sold one to Colin McCann for a guinea, I think.
Yes.
Just ridiculous when you think back. And yes, he subsequently gave it to the gallery's collection.
So McCann and Rita Angus, what other artists were there?
Well, I had stock. I didn't have shows because those artists couldn't provide me with a show during the period I had the gallery open. I had stock from Merksich, Wollaston. I did give a show to Alison Duff. She filled the gallery with her small bronzes. And a few artists who've dropped out of sight. Mm. Now. But my opening show was of Michael Nicholson, and he's still alive. He's in his 90s, I believe. Mm-hmm. Working in Wellington, and he showed some interesting works, and we might have sold one of those.
Mm.
I don't know how many sales I made through that through the initial, the opening year, but it wouldn't have been more than probably half a dozen.
So the dealer gallery went on from Argus to Icon, Barry Lett, New Vision, and that was it. But you changed direction at that point. Where did you go from?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't afford to keep it up because, as I say, I was working at the Herald from 7 till midnight during the week, reading copy. And it was just, it was just not possible to keep it going for very long. I think I lasted about 18 months.
Hmm.
And then I did other things, a bit of gardening, landscape gardening and so on. And one day I walked down Queen Street and this is the sort of thing you could do back in the 50s, from the top, from Crankerby Road, right down to the markets down behind the old Tebbit Bars. And I picked up about 30 jobs just by going into businesses that looked interesting and saying, have you got a vacancy for me? And so then I had to choose which job I'd take, and I took a job offered to me at George Walker's, the Queen Street Auction House, and they were the leading auctioneers in the country probably at the time, general auctioneers, as a sort of trainee auctioneer. And that led to, after a year or two, to my leaving Walker's and starting Cordy's. There's quite an interesting story attached to that, because I was anxious to get the manager, Norman Weiberg, to look at having New Zealand art sales. And this was because I'd seen two very lovely Hoyt watercolours sitting on an uncatalogued Thursday general sale, with all the rubbish and old mattresses and fridges and things. And I thought, this is crazy, this material should be held and put into a special sale. And so anyway, I phoned up George Fraser, who was the director of Fletcher's and whom I knew, and said he should come and have a look at these. And he did, and then he got Sir James in, and they bought them. And they consider that to be the start of the Fletcher collection. So as Walker's didn't seem very interested in having art sales,
yes,
I thought, well, I'll leave and see if I can start a specialist art auction house.
Yes.
And I was lucky at the time because there was a big trunk full of Lloyd etchings that I managed to source for Walker's, and they subsequently bought them off Walker's elderly daughters who wanted the money.
Mm.
So rather than dribble them out over years, they paid, I think, £200 for the lot. And they made £500 within a month or two. And the manager we were having morning tea in Walker's cafeteria.
Mm.
And a dealer from Wellington was sitting in there, and he dabbled in selling a bit of art amongst his antique furniture and so on. And he said, you've made a decent profit out of those. I'll give you 50 quid for the balance. And I was outraged because I knew just what these things were going to be worth. So I leapt up and said, you can't do that. That's silly. Too cheap. I'll give you £100 for them. Not having the faintest idea I was going to get the £100 from. So my offer, the dealer, Reg Longdon was his name, he didn't raise the offer. So the manager was obliged to let me have them, which then put me in this difficult position of paying for them. So I must have discussed it with Colin McCann and Pat Handley and Hamish Keith and a couple of others, and they all forked up £10 each, and we bought them. And then we sat around one evening at somebody's house, I can't remember where, and we made them, we parcelled them up into, how many garages were in the country at the time? Public garages, I don't know, maybe, what, 20? Or if you count all the little regional ones?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
We parcelled them up and sent them off sale or return, you know. And I don't think any, one of them came back, one of the parcels came back. So we quickly got our money back, plus a decent profit. And on the basis of that, I started Cordies.
Yes.
And then we sat around and had a meeting about, you know, how this would proceed. And first of all, we needed a name for the business. And I said, well, it's important that it's got a good ring to it, like Christie's or Sotheby's, you know. And, of course, Hamish was at that meeting, and he volunteered his middle name. Hamish Cordy Keith. So that's how Cordy was named. It was successful business, and even in those early days, because we sold antiques as well.
Yes,
and antiques were in demand.
And the mandate was antiques and art, and that was it. Was it the core?
Antiques, Maori artifacts, and art.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
In which I had to become an instant expert in all of those fields because we couldn't employ anyone else.
Yes. Yeah. And after a period, you pulled back out of Cordy's.
8 years, I think, I was there. I'd made our accountant, Erica Ferrados, she was then, a partner, a director and a partner. And I wanted to expand the business and do some more interesting things, and she was against it at the point where she wouldn't talk to me at all. We'd spend a whole day or two without a single word passing between us, which was not the way to really run a business. But anyway, I was thinking, I just wasn't quite sure how I was going to deal with the situation when Ross Fraser, who was working at the Art Gallery as librarian,
yes,
told me that there was a vacancy coming up for an exhibition. No, wait a minute, am I getting out my... Yes, that's right. This is the second... This is under Gil Docking, when Gil Docking was the director. There was a vacancy for an exhibitions officer. So I applied, and I got the job.
Back to the art gallery.
Back to the art gallery, yes.
And now tell me about the exhibitions program. I know that you initiated the blockbuster exhibitions in New Zealand, and we'll talk about that. But you were also initiating New Zealand shows, monograph shows, that sort of thing?
Yes, and I'm just trying to think of a major New Zealand show that we held. Colin was very active. He was, although he was designated keeper, he was very active in promoting shows of contemporary New Zealand art. And so he was well ahead of me in that respect, because he had, you know, he knew all the South Island artists, some that I'd never met, like the Doris Lusks and all these people. And so generally I didn't have to worry about... beg your pardon, you see, this is the memory playing up. Colin wasn't there then.
Ah.
He was there under Westbrook and right, my first stint, but not the second time I was there. We never mounted, I don't think, one seriously important exhibition of contemporary New Zealand art. Maybe those programs were already in... had been slotted in before I arrived. I don't know why, but I, of course, Richard Teller Hirsch became the director during my time there, because after Docking, he left to go back to Australia, and there was Ernie Smith, I think, followed him very briefly.
No, Ernie came after Hirsch.
Oh, Ernie came after Hirsch. Well, maybe Hirsch came straight after Docking then.
Yeah, it would
yes,
be.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And he was interested in big international shows and sort of gave me carte blanche, really, because I'd only been there, I think, 3 months. And I was packed off on a world trip to put the Constable show together.
Yes.
And this was because John Stagpool, bless him, came and saw me and said, look, I've got access to John Stagpool's grandson, who's also a John Constable's grandson,
yes,
I beg. Grandson, who's got a few things, including Constable's easel, and he's got some, you know, drawings and one or two paintings, and he would lend them to the gallery. So around that core, we mounted this big exhibition. And I remember going over to the town hall to get the treasurer to issue me with my air tickets and so on. And he said, I don't think he said bloody hell, but he did say, I've been working for council for 25 years and I haven't been out of Auckland. And you've been here three months and you're going off on a trip. This is, you know, he was very upset. When I came back from the trip, he died. The shock was too much. Anyway, I went off on that trip and made contacts overseas. We had a wonderful constable show. Tate. Who wrote the catalogue for us? Reynolds.
Yes.
He was a constable expert, and we approached him, and he agreed to write for the catalogue and also to lend a couple of paintings from the collection there too.
Yes.
And I went to Boston, I went to New York, I went to
And you came Holland, to the Netherlands, because that's when I first met you.
I went to Holland.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful trip. It was very exciting for me.
And the show was a great success.
The show was a huge success. Now, Ross, the painter Ross, elderly moment.
Fraser?
No.
Ritchie.
Ross Ritchie.
Yes.
Was the designer at the gallery.
Right.
And we had a great relationship.
Yes.
A very productive relationship. And together we dreamed up the whole sort of promotion for this exhibition.
Yes.
Badges for school children to, you know, encourage them to come to the show and get a free badge, and calendars with constable illustration. You know, I think the invariably, not the Heywayne, but some famous constable painting on the calendars. And all these things were available for people who attended the exhibition. There was a hardback covered catalogue and a soft covered catalogue. And then we also ran beside the exhibition an audiovisual show, which included live actors. And I'm ashamed to say I can't remember the name of the playwright at the moment, but he wrote a little play based on Constable's life, and it was performed every day at certain hours, and it packed out one of the galleries. It was very popular. It was very well done. I know Alan Smythe was involved in the music side of it.
Yeah.
So the show was a huge success. I think the attendance was over 60,000,
yeah,
which is more than packed into a rugby match.
Yeah, no, that's marvellous. Mm. And along the way, you were mentioning people, you know, who keep popping up in the cultural life of Auckland. Alan Smythe, you know, the man who initiated the concerts in the Domain, and so on.
Yes.
But you, by now, you've established the first deal. Well, you going back a step earlier than that. You with Ian Firth had got pottery going on the shore. You have established the first, albeit on a very small scale, the first dealer gallery in Auckland. You've established the first specialist antique and fine arts auction house. You've now initiated the blockbuster exhibitions at the gallery. These are the things that people don't know about you, but you've pioneered so much.
Oh, we did some great shows. We had the Surrealist show.
Yes.
Which is another great show. We had a Van Gogh show, didn't we? But that was very small, and I'd left the gallery by the time that arrived.
I can refresh your memory on that, because that's what you came to talk to me about in the Netherlands. It was when I was working at Kroonemuller. And it was to be basically an exhibition of drawings. That was your idea. And we were successful in persuading the Kroonemuller Museum to lend a large collection of drawings, and to that you added about 6 or 7 paintings from other sources. And then what happened was the Netherlands had been quite pro-Israel at that time. Mm. It was the beginning of all the international problems. And the Dutch government, fearful of the safety of the drawings, withdrew the loan. And you proceeded with that half dozen or 7 paintings. And that was a great success, that little exhibition of just a handful of paintings.
As I say, I'd left the gallery by the time the show arrived. And so I wasn't involved in the sort of promotion of it.
Right, but you had organised it.
Well, I guess I made a contribution to the initiation of it. But I thought the Japanese government pressured for a show, and they got being much more important to the economy of Holland, no doubt. they superseded us. So I don't. Yes. So I don't think we ever saw those drawings, did we?
No, we didn't. No. And I.
Oh, we had a very good. Yeah.
I'd been involved in assisting Krøller Müller in writing the catalogue. And in translating it all out of Dutch into English, but I'd done all that work. It was ready to be printed, and that was when it was.
Oh well, perhaps they should relook at it now. and there was the Dutch master drawings show.
Yes.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the relatively short time you were there, you ticked off quite a number of important exhibitions that were really setting the pattern for the future for the. Well, for Auckland Art Gallery, but then subsequently for one or two other art galleries in New Zealand. The exhibition that got a lot of publicity, attracted big audiences.
Mm. Dutch Master Engravings, I think it was called. We had one painting from the Met.
Yes.
And part of the deal was that the head of the department, John Walsh,
yes,
had to come out, had to escort the painting into the country to look after it, and so he was very good, and he gave talks and then escorted the painting home again.
Yes.
That was a very successful show too.
And when I came to do the Monet exhibition a bit later at Auckland Art Gallery, John Walsh was a key figure in helping with that as well.
Yes.
And of course John Walsh subsequently became the director of the Getty Museum. Interesting contacts down the years. You left the City Art Gallery and went back into commerce?
After the Constable show, I went over to the... by now I was married with children coming, and I felt that I needed a rise, and that I, as a reward for this hugely successful exhibition, I should be given a rise. So I went over and saw the new treasurer, and asked for the rise, and he said, "I can't do that. You can't." And I said, "Well, if I don't get a rise, I'll have to leave." He said, "Well, leave." And he said, "I can't give you a rise because you're on a grading of something, and I'll have to give every draftsman in the city, the same rise, so you can't have a rise." So I left, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but fortunately I'd met Barry Cramp, who was developing the old Millen and Choice building into what would have been the first sort of 246 type operation.
Yep.
But his financiers were was the Security Bank, and they went spectacularly bust, and that affected Barry's ability to do what he's planning to do with that building. But anyway, his wife was interested in art, and they wanted to open a little gallery in Custom Street. In fact, they'd already opened the gallery, and it only had, I think, one or two shows. And I was horrified to see what they'd done to the place. Was they'd got shagpile carpet, white shagpile carpet, not only laid across the floor, but it went right up the walls, all around the gallery. And I suppose it made good acoustic sense, I said, "Well, I'll come and run your gallery. You'll have to change the policies, and you'll have to change the walls and get rid of that shagpile." We had to rake up, every day we had to rake up all the excess fluff and stuff off these. We could fill two rubbish bags with all this fluff every day. But I heard Gordon Brown tell me about this artist he'd seen in Dunedin, called Graham Sidney, and that he thought he was someone that I should contact and give a show to. So I shot down to Dunedin, met Graham, and was impressed with his work, these very early works of Central Otago landscapes and so on. And I said he must have a show in Auckland, and he was a bit diffident about it, thinking, "Oh, I don't know." Well, he was a very insecure young artist at that stage, because I think he was still very much the amateur. I think he was teaching. And of course, his father was saying to him, "Oh, these Aucklanders, you can trust them, you better..." Anyway, we had a show, and it was a complete sellout. on the opening night. People were queuing up because we did a nice coloured postcard of one of the works.
Yes.
And mailed it out, and they were queuing up in Custom Street, waiting for the doors to open. They rushed in, and red stickers went up everywhere. And so, and when I priced the works, Graham said, "Oh, you'll never get those prices. I've never sold a painting at those prices, you know." And he was amazed. So he's been a very loyal friend ever since.
Yes.
So that was the first show we put on in that gallery. But I had been saying to Barry, "Look, this is not a suitable space. We need much more space. There's no storage." And he owned the building across the road, which was the old John Bates building. I think it was a three or four-story building. So he said, "All right, I'll give you the first floor, one above ground." In America, the first floor is the ground floor, isn't it? Yeah. But one above ground. And you can have that for a gallery. And that was a huge space.
Yes.
And that became the Barrington Gallery. And we had some great shows there. And Barry was very generous. And once again, I set off around the world organizing shows. We had a Picasso engraving show. We had Jim Dine.
Yep.
We had photorealism from New York. We did some very interesting stuff. And we did have New Zealand shows. We put on a major New Zealand show with Claremont and Maddox, all the hot young artists at the time, Brent Wong. Oh, goodness, I can't remember them all, but it was a very good show.
Yes.
And a good catalogue. And then what happened then was that Barrington Cramp's finances, being affected by the state of the economy at the time and the collapse of Security Bank and so on, looked a bit hazardous to me, and I was very worried that artists weren't necessarily going to get paid when we sold a painting. And so I moved on and opened my own gallery in High Street. Lawn Street, I should say. The Peter Webb Galleries, yes, that's when that Webb's as a gallery was born.
Now, I'll come back to Peter Webb Galleries and the subsequent development of the new auction house. But a sidebar of Peter Webb Galleries was Art New Zealand. So here you are initiating something else again.
Well, Ross Fraser, whom, as I admit, at the gallery and the Orton Art Gallery, remained a good friend, and he wanted me to do he persuaded me to do a nice little brochure for every show, mm-hmm. and which Ross designed and wrote for, and they went out, and they were very good. But after about a year, he said, "You should be developing this. You can afford it," and I couldn't, but. he said, "Let's. Why don't we do something more like a little magazine?" And so I thought about it. And about this time, the Auckland Star gave up its arts page. Hamish Keith used to write a page on the visual arts for the Star. And it recorded exhibitions and so on, and provided a record of what you'd done, what you were doing in your galleries, you know. And so they closed that down, and I thought, you put on a show, you go to a lot of trouble to put on a good show, there's no one reviewing it, and there's no record of it. So we need a little magazine, and so that's how Art New Zealand was born. And Ross was the editor.
And that was the first art periodical. There'd been a sort of newspaper publication in the 60s, as I recall, but that was the first proper magazine about the arts in New Zealand since Art in New Zealand prior to the Second World War.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and of course it evolved into a very ambitious magazine.
Still going today.
Yes.
Yes, I think we built it up to about a circulation of about 4,000, which was very pleasing. But it still didn't pay its way, really.
And at a certain point you cut it free from the Webb stable?
Because I had to sell all the advertising. I mean, that's what paid the printer's bills.
Yes.
And we did get into a bit of financial strife because, again, the economic situation made it difficult to get people to advertise or pay their bills if they did advertise.
Mm.
And so I remember we owed the printer quite a lot of money at one stage, and I asked Warwick Brown, who was a regular gallery visitor, very influential in contemporary art in New Zealand at the time, whether I should consider, you know, bring some other people in and what should be done about the situation. And he assembled a group of people who, from mostly from Russell McVeigh, I think, to support it. And a company was formed, and that company still exists, the Art Magazine Press, I think it's called.
Right.
Yeah. And so it carried on. And I just had shares in that company, but right.
And so now you're concentrating on the development of Peter Webb Galleries, which has had a singular history since then. Tell us about that and how the market for New Zealand contemporary art is increasing throughout this period.
Well, I was with my gallery in Lawn Street, and I'd given up the Art New Zealand, publishing Art New Zealand. I was publishing, managing editor and advertising director all in one. And that released me to concentrate a bit more on the exhibitions. And we had some very good shows. We had McCann's Angels in Bed show. And we had a very good Gordon Walters exhibition. I'm just trying to think how many other major shows we had. But, a very good show by young Phil Claremont.
So Peter Webb arrived at Peter Webb Galleries and the beginning of an amazing story of the gallery evolving from a gallery that exhibits artists' works, and albeit in a very progressive and new way, to Webb's as we know it and have known it for the last 20 or so years as a resale auction house, and critically important in the whole development of the art market, particularly the contemporary art market.
Right. Yes, about that time, I was still publishing Art New Zealand, and I was still having to go out and sell the advertising. So I started to think about bringing in someone else as a partner. Ross had no money and no desire to be a partner, I don't think. He might have accepted the shares if I'd gifted them to him, but I couldn't afford to do that. So that idea occurred and persisted with me for a while. But at the same time, I was trying to think of a way of propping up Art New Zealand, which was probably losing the gallery money. Mm. And I thought of, let's try and publishing. We've got a designer, we've got a good printer, and we know a little bit about publishing. Let's try and publish a magazine in Auckland. We'll call it The Aucklander, and a magazine that might make money for us and support Art New Zealand. So I floated that idea, and I just recently met Alistair Taylor, who'd published all those Goldie books, you know.
Yes.
And I'd also met somebody else, a John Davis, who was the inventor of the book that children's books that you could read underwater, which made them kind of indestructible. And he'd come back from London. He made a lot of money. He actually also invented the little university crammers that students bought.
Oh yes, I remember those.
To sit an examination, you know. And he took that idea overseas, and he made a lot of money. And John was back, sort of looking for something to do, and so I thought, if I could get these two on board, you know, we should be very successful. So a company was formed, and they were both directors, shareholders. Alistair Taylor was responsible for the editorial and that side of things. John Davis was the financial director, and I was the advertising manager as usual, and I had to go and source the advertising. So I was seldom at the gallery, and this determined me to solve the problem of whether or not to employ to engage another party as a partner in the gallery. So I don't know whether I think I must have approached Don Wood. Anyway, Don Wood turned up and was pleased to buy into it, and he joined us.
And Don had been been Icon Gary.
He'd been Icon Gary, and yeah. That was a very successful Gary, as I recall. It had some, you know, I mean, they gave artists like Don Binney and Michael Smither and so on early, possibly their first real exposure in Auckland. I don't think they'd shown anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Sadly, they were after my time, so I didn't get the benefit of them because they were pretty much instant successes, I think. Mm. Anyway, Don joined us, and then the only problem with that is it added another salary to the the cost of running the gallery, and I was spending just about all my time working for the Aucklander magazine. So there were still financial difficulties, and because of my previous involvement with antiques, I thought of putting on a one-off auction and hiring a venue for it and sourcing antiques and New Zealand art to raise some capital for the support the business, the gallery business. And there was a little antique dealer down the road from me in Lawn Street, he specialised in jewellery, but he was very knowledgeable about other antiques and silver and so on. He knew where to source things. He was also pretty good with Persian rugs. Mm. So I went and saw him, and I asked him if he would support the idea of an auction. And I think this market was very difficult at the time for everybody, and he probably saw the opportunity to unload some stock and raise some funding too. Mm. And together we mounted a very good show. We put out a very cheap little catalogue, but the actual quality of the stuff we offered was great. We had Goldies, we had mostly early New Zealand painting, but we did have, I think we had a McCann, at least one McCann, and one or two good contemporary paintings. Mm. We held it at the down the bottom of St. Stephen's Avenue. What was that? I pulled that down subsequently, the hotel there.
Yeah, the White Heron.
The White Heron, in their ballroom. And we packed the ballroom out to overflowing, and people like Gus Fisher were there sitting in the front row and putting his hand up regularly. And it was a hugely successful sale. We made very good money out of it. So we decided we'd do another one, in a few months' time. So we had a second one, and that was equally successful. And so the concept then was, well, why don't we combine both the gallery and an auction business and look for new premises where we can hold the sales on site?
Yes.
So we moved to we found space in the old TNG building. Don Wood found the space, and he being an architect, you know, designed the premises that we would use. And we moved over there, and so we divided the space, and the gallery took up about a third of it, and the auction business took up the balance, along with storage and offices and so on. And we ran that as a gallery come auction business for about a year or two, and then the auction business was growing, 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 and the gallery was shrinking, shrinking, shrinking. And we had some very good shows there. We had a major show of Gretchen Albrecht's I think the first show perhaps of her big hemisphere paintings.
Yes. Yeah.
We had another good Claremont show. We had a big Billy Apple show, which was very successful, mm-hmm. because I worked hard to... It was called Sold, and everything had to be pre-sold for the exhibition opening. Mm. And there was one big painting which occupied one wall, and on the opposing wall had a row of smaller prints, silkscreen prints. And I had to get around and sell all those prior to the opening, and I managed to get most of them sold to public galleries. So that was a very successful show, and I think one of Billy's best shows ever, really. Mm. And then we closed the gallery with McCann's a major show of McCann. I just can't, just for the moment, I can't remember the name of the, we gave the exhibition. It was named after, of course, the series of works, but... That was a sad event, really. But at that event, at the opening of that show, I met my now wife, Anne in Copeland, as she was then. And she came to work for us as a sort of secretarial assistant come receptionist.
Yes.
And after a year or two, we became an item, as they say today, and then eventually married. But, well, 10 years later, we married. But the auction business was demanding of the space, it was demanding of our time, and so the Gary suffered. It was a shame, but there you are. And there were other Garys opening around the town, and you had to be totally full-time to make a success of a dealer Gary.
And so the life you've been describing traverses the period when it was very hard to sell contemporary New Zealand art at all, and when you did, for very modest sums, to now the basis of a really mature market where there are dealers, quite a number of dealers representing artists and showing their work regularly, and a resale market where workers coming back onto the market and sustaining prices. So that's a big change.
Yes, and I think the auction market has really helped that a great deal.
Yes.
Because the only way of reselling a painting, if you bought a Dom Binney or a McCann or any other contemporary work in those days, prior to the auctions, and you needed the money, or you were leaving the country or something, and you went back to the dealer you bought it from and hoped that he would sell it for you. And then it went into his storeroom. And, of course, they were always under pressure from artists to sell the latest works. And so they tended to moulder away in storerooms and, you know, not get exposure. So it was very difficult. And, of course, that didn't encourage buying of art either, because people had to be convinced that they were never going to want to sell it. Or if they did have to sell it, they were willing to accept whatever price that, you know, it might fetch. But the auction business then exposed the works, promoted the works, and found, I think, a new market that was more speculative than your traditional and serious collector. People that enjoyed painting but would perhaps not have got engaged if, you know, and then, of course, there are the people who like the atmosphere of an auction. They like the competitive feeling.
Exactly, yes.
And, it was surprising how quickly you could fill a sarum with people, you know, 200 or 300 people.
Yes. So now you've got a situation where art is being sold first time up, but art now has a totally viable second time round and even third time round market. And as you've said, that encourages people to be more willing to buy first time round because they can refine their collections. Out of all of this starts to evolve collecting. Rather than just owning artworks to hang on the wall of your home or your office or wherever, people start to collect now, to form collections with the collection as its focus.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say that was encouraged, if not entirely made possible, by the resale market?
Well, it would have certainly enlarged that market. You know, I mean, even today, there's still relatively few who do have serious collections as such. But certainly it encouraged people to think about buying more art than they could actually fit on the wall.
Yes.
Because then they had the opportunity to regularly change their environment. Yes.
And we saw collecting cooperatives and so on. You mentioned Warwick Brown before. And
yes, well, we Bay, that's right. That we put together the Prospect Collection, Warwick and I, and one or two others, again, Russell McVeigh's, because they had a very interesting art collection hanging on their office walls, which Warwick had assembled. He was very popular with all the dealer Garys because he was a regular buyer at openings.
Yes.
So we formed the Prospect Collection with a view to encouraging the purchase of contemporary art.
Yes.
And the idea was that it would run for 10 years and then be revisited and the members would decide what they wanted to do, whether carry on or split it up. And at the end of 10 years, in the Prospect Collection's case, they all decided they wanted to be collectors in their own right and not have to live with other people's choices. Now, I was their advisor or consultant for the first 3 years, I think. It was about 3 years. And then after that, they decided it would be more fun if they had a little buying committee each year. Well, it was in the first 3 years that the major works were bought, and when they sold the collection, Webb sold it at the end of 10 years, the ones that made really good money were the ones bought in the first 3 years. And some of the latter works didn't sell all that well, but anyway, they had fun. They did very well. I think they spent a total of $60,000 over the 10-year period in buying New Zealand art. And I know that Webb's gave them a cheque for about $600,000 after deductions at the end of the 10-year period.
Not bad.
And that, of course, again, stimulates buying because they think, oh, you can have fun, you can have enjoyment from owning art, and, you know, you're probably making an investment.
Over the, particularly over recent years, but over the, all of that period, we've seen progressive increase in value, and we've now, in more recent years, seen some really spectacular values emerging on the New Zealand market. And of course the same phenomenon has been happening abroad, that 20th century art coming on the market for unbelievable prices. Do you think, well, first question, do you think that the New Zealand market is, that trend is because of the international market? Is it influenced by the international market? Or are these parallel things that have happened?
The New Zealand market is quite distinct from and you know, really separate from and more or less unrelated to, I think, the international market, because it is very much a local market. You can't readily sell New Zealand. I mean, a painter might be very popular here, but you take him out of New Zealand, even just as far as Australia, and with one or two exceptions like McCann. But, I mean, McCann sells in Australia because he's generally supported by New Zealanders living over there.
Yes.
But I know that I talked to the head of Sotheby's Australia about McCann a long time ago, and he said, well, how many major works are available, you know, for sale? Because we were talking about the international market at the time. And I said, well, most of his major works are in public collections now. And he said, well, if, you know, to get a market internationally, there has to be a supply. People have to become familiar with the name and the prices being achieved and all that sort of thing. And if there's not enough comes out onto the market, then, you know, you're not going to go anywhere. And that's pretty much true of most New Zealand art. The supply is insufficient to ever excite the international market.
Yes. I remember years and years ago talking to a New York dealer and rattling on about international art, and she turned to me and she said, "What's that?" So I attempted to explain what I meant by international art. She said, "No, people in New York buy New York art, people in Chicago buy Chicago art." There's a great deal of truth about that, isn't there? There is an international market, but in a way it's a bit like London, it's an assembly of villages.
Yes, yes. And it's probably only for a relatively small number of artists, too. But I remember I made the mistake of taking a great big canvas from the Lion Breweries collection that got broken up, which we sold. A huge canvas of lovely Grecian dressed maidens lounging along amongst marble seats and so on, and beside a pool. And I thought, oh, Texas, I could just see a Texas oil millionaire wanting to buy this. So I took a huge coloured photograph, which I had made, over to Texas, and thought I'll find a buyer for it, because I didn't think there'd be a buyer in New Zealand for it. It was by William Reynolds Stevens.
Yes.
And when I got to the dealers in Texas, they said, no, they buy cowboys, they're not interested. But fortunately, one of the dealers there knew a dealer in New York, and the dealer in New York knew a dealer in London, and it got by relay, this dealer in London was alerted to it. So when we put it up in Auckland, one dealer had flown out from London and another dealer was bidding from his bed because of the timing. And we got a world record price to $225,000, which was way and above, you know, what had been paid previously for for Reynolds Stevens.
Right.
But, I'll just make the point that, you know, there isn't an international market in the sense that there are people looking for art of international interest everywhere. And, Texans are... They like pictures of cowboys.
And the high prices that we see being achieved these days, how sustainable do you think it is?
Well, it's always been fashion. governed to some extent, has it? I mean, you think about way back in the 19th century, the Victorian painters and the Pre-Raphaelites, and you know how they went out of fashion and suddenly came back into fashion. And but because of there is an international market now in the way that there wasn't then, those artists are selling at good prices, regardless of of fashion to some extent. Because you've got buyers in Russia now, squillionaires, and buyers in Japan and now in China, who are, you know, thinking beyond their own local art and looking for, not just for the possible possibility of financial gain, but for prestige.
As an art historian, you're tempted to look for what's happened in the past and to see parallels with what might be happening now. And the 17th century in the Netherlands was the emergence of the modern market, but a similar phenomenon to the one that we're experiencing now. There was too much capital chasing too little property. Land and so on was no longer available, and people started investing in art and antiques, and then it became curiosities and tulip bulbs and so on. I remember in 1642, Rembrandt achieved less for the night watch than the top auction price for a single tulip bulb. And of course, the thing is that the bottom drops out of these markets.
Very quickly.
It's all capital chasing something to invest in. And there's this feeling that maybe this is just what's happening right now.
To some extent, that's true. It's true. And I mean, I won't mention names, but it's happened to a number of artists in New Zealand whose prices 5 years ago were 10 times what they are today.
Right. Well, Peter, it's been a phenomenal career. I can't think of another person in my lifetime in New Zealand, so let's say, you know, the visual arts in New Zealand from the Second World War on, who has been at the cutting edge of the initiation of so many different things within the public visual arts sector and in the commercial visual arts sector. Wherever you see something emerging, pretty much sure that Peter Webb's there at the beginning of it somewhere.
Yes, well, I might have had more success if I'd been more persevering, but I quickly was... I mean, I live very much in the present and future. I don't, you know, live in the past at all, which is why I've got such bad memory about some of these things. But so I'm always looking at the next idea, the next thing. And yes, I think that I could have been a magazine publisher, a good magazine publisher, and I could have probably been a much better dealer if I'd persisted in those fields. But
that's very modest of you. It's been a fantastic contribution. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Rodney.